Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the New Year's Eve broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the New Year's Eve broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. I'm your host, Bob Curie. Well, it's New Year's Eve, and I don't know what kind of live listenership we will have tonight. I expect most of the people who listen to this show listen in archive and probably are occupied tonight. But in case anybody is listening live and wants to call in, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. And the chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat. I guess I'll open the show on a somber note. There was another terrorist attack this evening in Istanbul, Turkey. A gunman opened fire in a nightclub packed with revelers celebrating the New Year's holiday, and latest reports are 35 killed and many wounded, and I suspect those numbers will go up as more information becomes available. And I'm afraid this is just another somber reminder of the increasing epidemic of terrorism that has been afflicting the planet for the past decade and a half, and which is certainly going to require a lot of government attention on the part of the new administration in the coming year. So our prayers and sympathy go out to the deceased and their family and friends, and we have to hope that somehow the civilized powers on the earth will find a way to curb this epidemic of violence. For tonight's show, we'll just have a few discussion points. We will go over to Times Square as the clock approaches midnight, New York time, to take a peek as to what's going on there. It's cold over much of the country, certainly quite cold in New York, so the revelers are braving the elements to get their party spirits unleashed, and we'll see what they are up to in a few minutes. For the serious subjects tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about the election, and then I guess a couple of cultural comments. regarding what direction our society is going in the coming years and where it needs to change course. But as far as the election, I mean, the sour grapes are still very much in view in the mainstream media, with Hillary Clinton and her supporters putting out one theme after another, explaining away her loss and blaming it on Russian hacking. And, of course, the Obama administration is trolling along with this, manufacturing hacking themes for the people to get resentful about. Now, Russian hacking, I have no doubt that it exists, and it has gone on for far longer than the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. We've had huge hacking problems in this country throughout the Obama years, about which he has done absolutely nothing. We had the hacks of major companies like Sony and Yahoo. We had hacks of the IRS. We had hacks of the Defense Department, Office of Personnel Management, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of records, including records of people's security clearances, people with security clearances, their social security numbers and contact information and address information, all stolen, and the Obama administration just was so blasé about it. Nothing was done. But in order to delegitimize the Trump election, all of a sudden Hillary, her supporters in the Democratic Party, and the Obama administration is really playing up the hacking theme for all of its worth. But when you look at the election, you have to see, I mean, it just leaps out on you, at you, that the election had nothing to do with hacking. It was simply Hillary was rejected by the heartland. When you look at the six states that Hillary Clinton lost that Barack Obama won, I did a little research and looked at the decline in her popular vote share. For example, in 2012, Obama carried Pennsylvania 51.9% of the vote, with 51.9% of the vote. In 2016, Hillary only got 47.5% and lost the state. So she did 4.4 points worse than Obama did. And then when you look at the other states in the industrial Middle West, you see similar results. In Ohio, she was down 7.4% from where Obama was. 7.4 points from where Obama was. In Michigan, 7 points. Wisconsin, 6.3 points. Iowa, a gigantic 10.3 points. And in Florida, where a lot of Midwesterners go when they retire, Hillary lost 2.5 points. So what happened was the Democrats lost the heartland. It's as simple as that. And they didn't lose it because Russia had some message that resonated with the heartland. Hillary Clinton lost the heartland all by herself. I think people were looking at the performance of the Obama administration over the past 4 years on issues that mattered to them, immigration, economic growth, terrorism, and they decided that the message that Hillary had was not for them, and they didn't vote for her. And it really is as simple as that. Now, on some of the best criticisms of the Hillary whining campaign are coming from the left, not from the right. And one of the people that I've been starting to pay a lot of attention to is the blogger H.A. Goodman on YouTube. He's a lefty, a very big Bernie Sanders supporter, and he just is going after Hillary for her lousy campaign. with all the energy at his command. So I'm going to play a few minutes of one of his recent videos. I think this posted today.
This is H.A. Goodman. I'm an author, columnist, and journalist. And to read my writing and to see my latest CNN appearances and my MSNBC and RT appearances, you can go to hagoodman.com. I'm going to be starting a new publication February 1st. You're going to love it, whether you're progressive, independent, conservative. There's something for everybody on this new website on or around February 1st. Not many people know that Russia dropped its no-first-use policy of nuclear weapons in 1993. We do not have a no-first-use policy. What does that mean? What does that mean to... what does that mean in regards to U.S.-Russia relations? Well, since we both have the greatest amount of nuclear weapons on the planet, if you have a no-first-use policy, you reserve the right to launch whenever you feel it's justified. You don't have to be attacked, or missiles don't have to be coming at you. If you have a no-first-use policy, that means you reserve the right to launch whenever you feel it's necessary. We had a Cold War with Russia for over 50 years. Most Democrats, many Democrats, were loyal to Hillary Clinton, almost loyal like a cult following, don't understand that a renewed Cold War is a very bad thing. So before I get to Trump reversing President Obama's sanctions and bringing back the diplomats that he expelled, the Russian diplomats, I'm going to read you a 1993 article from the New York Times. Russia drops pledge of no first use of atom arms. Moscow, November 3rd, 1993. The Russian Defense Ministry confirmed today the Russian military doctrine adopted on Tuesday abandoned the old Soviet pledge not to use nuclear weapons first. We don't have that pledge either. Why on earth would you want to increase tensions between two countries that already had decades of similar tensions? Because Hillary Clinton lost $1.2 billion. She wasted, she burned $1.2 billion. This is not about the U.S. election or national security. There was no national security. Well, the national security found in the 22 top secret emails with special access program intelligence on her unencrypted private server that she used for convenience and that where she deleted yoga emails, that actually is national security. So this is all a smokescreen. But the point is, allegedly hacking, because there's no proof. We haven't. WikiLeaks is not even mentioned in the 13-page report, and Russia is barely mentioned, but WikiLeaks, the country Russia, there's Russian hackers, but the country of Russia is barely mentioned, but WikiLeaks is not mentioned at all in the 13-page Russian hacker report. There's no link, there's no evidence, there's no emails from Russian hackers to WikiLeaks or from the state, the country of Russia to WikiLeaks. So there's no proof or evidence that WikiLeaks and Russia have conspired alongside Trump to harm Hillary's campaign. That being said, how was Hillary's campaign harmed? Her own words and emails were so repulsive to voters that they obviously had wanted nothing to do with her, at least in the swing states or in states that determine the election. But the issue is, why would you want to go ahead and create another Cold War? Because Hillary Clinton lost. She lost. Even 538 said that WikiLeaks didn't have that great of an impact. The head of the NSA said that WikiLeaks didn't have that great of an impact in terms of Hillary losing. Hillary voted for the Iraq War. Hillary Clinton called black youth super predators. Hillary Clinton used racism against Barack Obama. She fabricated a story about Bosnian sniper fire. She flip-flopped on the Keystone XL Trans-Pacific Partnership. She had an FBI criminal investigation, two of them. Anthony Weiner probe a week before the election, the FBI letter. You cannot win with an FBI criminal investigation pertaining to the handling of classified information. That is obvious. All of these issues, the favorability ratings, same as Trump, the fact that most American women found Hillary not honest and trustworthy. All of those reasons, in addition to the fact that DNC WikiLeaks emails proved categorically that she cheated Bernie Sanders, the more popular candidate, the more progressive candidate, that caused a fracture within the Democratic Party. All of those reasons completely destroyed enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, and she lost. So even if you wanted to say the Russians hacked into the election, which they didn't, they hacked into Podesta's emails and the DNC, if they allegedly hacked, if the propaganda is true, it wouldn't have been the U.S., it would have been a political party, number one. And number two, that wouldn't have tipped the scales. There's so many other issues. She was the subject of a criminal probe. Why would you vote for somebody who could serve jail time? They tried to say, well, it's just politics. No, it's not. Find a political candidate who ran for president under FBI criminal investigation. It's never happened.
Well, I think he makes the point, actually several points, really well. Number one, however upset the Obama people and the Hillary people were at the outcome of the election, to manufacture a crisis with Russia is the height of political irresponsibility because of the risk of engaging with another major nuclear power in a confrontational posture. Needlessly, where America's basic vital national interests are not involved. And then Goodman, makes the point that Hillary is a flawed candidate under FBI investigation, under two FBI investigations, and she led a fractured Democratic Party, fractured in large part by her determination and the part of the Democratic establishment to play a lot of dirty tricks on Bernie Sanders in order to manipulate the nominating process. So all of this is very obvious, but it seems to be the coastal elites that make the news. They just seem to be oblivious to all of this common sense reasoning out there, and they insist on the Russian hacking narrative, and it is increasingly look sillier and sillier, while at the same time looking riskier and riskier in terms of its impact on our relationships with Russia and our relationships across the globe. So I think the Obama and the Democratic people and Hillary and all the rest of them have not handled this election very responsibly. They are engaging in a massive outbreak of sour grapes, and I think that history is not going to look at them kindly. And looking at the clock, I don't think it's quite time to go to Times Square, but they're revving up over there. We'll be over there in a couple of minutes. Since Times Square is in New York and Wall Street is in New York, I thought I would go into the stock market a little bit, and there was a stock market rally that actually began before the November election took place, and it continued afterwards, and it's been dubbed by many the Trump rally, and there was some talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average breaching 20,000 by the end of the year. Well, it didn't quite make it. I think cooler heads have prevailed, and it stalled in the final couple of days. Now, I think that the long-term prospects for the economy are good if Donald Trump is able to deliver on his promises to negotiate better trade deals, to curb spending and regulation. But since markets are much more short-term in nature, there is an element of risk in the stock market right now that wasn't there a few months ago, because when you have a price move like this, it means that there's been multiple expansion in price earnings ratio, and if those and if earnings do increased earnings don't materialize to match the rise in prices, you have the potential for a correction. And at the same time, the Fed has been making it clearer and clearer and clearer that it is going to pursue a rising rate strategy in 2017 and beyond, and rising interest rates are never very good for the stock market. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there. Trump has to deliver. The market has to navigate the rising rate environment. And the market has had a substantial run-up, and it has to catch and hold its breath and wait for new economic news, good economic news, to supplement the euphoria that seemed to dominate the scene after the election. And finally, another thing that's in the background, which hasn't been getting much attention, is that part of the some of the activity that has been sustaining the stock market are debt finance buybacks of stock, which are, by reducing the share count, they boost earnings per share, but they have no economic value. Stock buybacks have no economic intrinsic economic value in themselves. And with a lower share count, companies get boost their dividends, also partially financed by debt. They get a boost in their quoted yields, and that makes them look good to yield-oriented investors. All of these techniques to maintain stock prices do get increasingly risky in a rising interest rate environment. It costs more to borrow the money to finance the stock buybacks and the dividends, and so you do have less margin for error if you're directing the finances of a major corporation. So there is definitely risk out there in the stock market, and I wouldn't be surprised after the run-up of November and December that the whole thing just pauses for breath, and then a lot is going to depend on just what priorities Trump pursues in his first 100 days in office, and how successful he is in getting his program through Congress. And I see Bob Montgomery in the chat. Want to welcome him, and I have a caller. That's my brother. Phil, is that you?
It's me.
Oh, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And I'm going to look at the clock here. Oh, it's time to go to Times Square. And then I have my second clip, which I promised I would play for Bob Montgomery. And that will be coming shortly. And that has to do with the state of the academic world, which has been a subject of some discussion online. But first, let's go and see what's going on in Times Square.
You really don't love the way I am. Oh, you're my favorite thing.
What happened to our live stream?
Oh,
Okay, so we stayed for the ball drop and the traditional rendition of New York, New York. Looking at the Times Square crowd, it looks very lively. It looks very cold over there. Unfortunately, the idiot de Blasio is on the stage, too. You have to have him ruin your New Year's by being present. That guy is such a troll. Of course, you know, I get such a kick out of looking at all those people on Times Square. You know, reminds me of younger days when I would actually go into Manhattan, although I never went to Times Square. But, I mean, there is no place to party like New York on New Year's Eve. It's funny that the clock has this big Toshiba logo on it. For people following the business news, Toshiba has become embroiled in a massive accounting scandal again, and its key leadership all had to resign, and the stock price is plummeting over another one of these attempts to manipulate earnings that seems to plague companies globally now these days. And of course their logo is right up there in Times Square because they have their name on the New Year's Eve clock. So kind of ironic considering all of that. So Happy New Year, everybody. The rest of our show, I don't think we'll go the full length of the show, but I did want to cover two things tonight. One was the stock, well, actually three. One was Hillary's performance of the swing states, which we've already gone into. And for people who joined us late, I went through the six states that Trump won, that Obama won in 2012, and that Hillary lost, and the substantial margins by which the Democratic vote in those states collapsed in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Florida. And in three of them, I think Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, the last time Republicans carried those states was either 1984 or 1988, which goes to show just how bad a candidate Hillary Clinton was. The second part of the discussion was about the stock market. The Dow did fail to reach 20,000. I think that there are some roadblocks as far as the continuation of the so-called Trump rally goes. But I think the long-term prospects for the economy and thus the market are good, depending on what happens in Trump's first year in office. And the last part of the what I wanted to cover tonight has to do with the state of the academy. You know, a lot of us on the more conservative-leaning part of the blogosphere were very frustrated with what we saw about the terrible coverage of the election, the total lack of attention to issues and what people were really concerned with on the part of the mainstream media. Now, how did this happen? Well, we all know that the media has been liberal-leaning. It has been for decades, but it has gone beyond bias. It has gone to just outright collusion with a very liberal, progressive propaganda machine type of operation, totally in bed with the Democratic Party, especially Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the more established parts of the Democratic Party, establishment-oriented parts of the Democratic Party. So, how did that happen? Well, I think the reason why it happened is that no profession is more aligned with the academy than journalism. Not even Hollywood and mass entertainment is as infected by what goes on the college campus, as is journalism. And, of course, we all know that over the past 30 years, the left has totally captured the academy. Now, I've been watching on YouTube the college tours by Milo Yiannopoulos, who is a senior editor at Breitbart, as he is doing a tour of American college campuses, trying to shatter the hold of political correctness and presenting an alternative point of view. And there was just a fascinating YouTube video of him at the University of Massachusetts, where he appeared with Stephen Crowder and Christina Hoff Sommers. And they were trying to, you know, make their presentation, and they were constantly being screeched at and screamed at by disruptors in the audience that were trying to silence them. It was just an amazing spectacle. The administrators and a good deal of the faculty on college campuses these days, especially those who are big proponents of feminism, are doing everything that they can to shut out and stifle anything that threatens their worldview. And the fact that this is the training ground for today's journalists explains a lot that is wrong, probably explains just about everything that is wrong with the American media today. And why it's losing, the mainstream media outlets are losing market share, not only to the alternative media, to non-liberal established media like Fox, but also to the foreign press. Increasing numbers of American citizens are paying more and more attention to the foreign press because they just don't trust what the press organs in their own country are telling them, because they become mouthpieces for the Obama administration. Well, I thought it would to illustrate the crisis that's going on in the academy. I'm going to play a part of a clip also on YouTube from the American Enterprise Institute, and hear Christina Hoff Sommers, a sort of dissident, pragmatic feminist, and Camille Paglia, who is a very well-known, provocative author who specializes in covering the arts and the humanities and the college campus scene, engaged in a dialogue on what's going on the American campus and talking about their experiences. So this is about 6 or 7 minutes long, and it is definitely worth a listen as to explain just how bad the dysfunction is.
You've heard about the safe spaces, young women. I gave a lecture at Oberlin and Georgetown a year ago, and they organized safe spaces for students who were triggered by a philosophy professor was going to induce PTSD because of what they objected to is that I might have some ideas that invalidate their experience.
They're institutionalizing neurosis.
Right?
That's what they're doing.
It's
absolute madness.
And have you heard the phase, the fashion on campus now is called intersectional feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposedly very progressive, and it's going to take feminism to a place where it's taking account of women with multiply marginalized identities, on and on. But all of the women, the practitioners, seem to meet at the intersection of propaganda and neurosis and rage. And they're bullying people. They're using feminism now. They're telling men, check your privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it's a good idea that the feminism be critiqued by class issues, because
yes.
What I have said all along is that what is being demanded is a kind of bourgeois protection, okay, a white middle class girl, okay, a kind of style, okay, the perfect little girl emerging from her parents' living room wants the same kind of protections on the college campus. So I've always felt there was a bourgeois element in this that was never sufficiently critiqued, and that what I see on the street are Latino women African-American women, okay, who may be middle class but have a working class background, as I did as an Italian, from an Italian immigrant family, who are able to handle themselves on the street, able to speak back, don't mind having strong voices and strong gestures.
Well, intersectionality started with those women. So it was a group of African-American women who were just fed up with the women's movement attending only to the, you know, needs of highly professional middle-class, upper-middle-class women. But it has been appropriated by mostly middle-class white women on the campus. Mm-hmm. So safe space was actually a word that was used in early black feminism, is where black women could just, and Hispanic women, places where they could just talk to each other and they weren't censored and they could mm-hmm. speak their minds. But now it means a place where, for example, young women at Brown University, if there's a debate that upsets them, they flee to a safe space where it was described in the New York Times by Judith Shulevitz. They had coloring books, crayons, tapes of frolicking puppies, bubbles. I mean, this is what feminism has come to.
And it's what education has come to, okay? Absolutely. The definition down, they're therapeutic, therapeutic resorts is what education has turned into.
Oh, yes, they have feeling circles. They have reflection journals, and they, I mean, it's this odd mix of mm-hmm. therapy and mm-hmm. and anger, mm-hmm. because they're the good word for this style of activism, they call them cry bullies, and it because they combine, they're both victim and victimizer, and they sort of do to other people this new style of campus intersectionality. They actually do to other people what they claim was done to them. Mm-hmm. They treat people, they objectify, and they stereotype, and they demonize, and then they try to get people punished.
Well, Christina, this is coming from the public schools, all right? It's coming from the public school education, which was devoid of knowledge of world history and world geography, and it is nothing but navel-gazing and the diversity training and being in all kinds of instructions about social interaction, when in fact, if the atrocities of history were revealed to young people, okay, they would be able to put their own little hurt feelings into perspective.
Into perspective. They have no perspective.
No.
And I think these anti-bullying programs, they're learning that even the slightest insult is a major event. You must bring in the adults. It was terrible. He called me a name. So they come to college thinking that if someone disagrees with them or says something that's distressing, that it's a catastrophe.
Yeah. To say this way, I call my feminism Amazon feminism. I've called it drag queen feminism,
right.
Street smart feminism. Because the drag queens of old knew how to handle themselves on the street. Okay, they could be a 6 foot tall, you know, African American guy, okay, in a dress, okay, and he knew how to pull off his high heels and defend himself on the street, okay, and what a tongue they had, etc. And now everything is about weakening students, not strengthening them.
Oh, it's exactly that. And now let's talk about the young men. Can you imagine being a young man on campus today? And what I see happening is just the way society used to police the sexuality of gay people, it's now sort of open season on the sexuality of heterosexual males.
Absolutely.
They're monitored, they're policed, and demonized.
And neutered. They're
yes.
neutered. By the time they get to the Ivy League, they've
right.
been neutered. Everything's been stripped off of them. Okay? They've been made to feel ashamed of anything virile. Okay,
right.
They have nothing to identify with. Right?
And they're taught their masculinity is a pathology mm-hmm. in need of a cure. Mm-hmm. And then it's
yeah.
offered to them in these gender studies programs. And it's not just gender studies. Now this philosophy that demonizes men, it's throughout the curriculum, and you're absolutely right. It's going on in the high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's coming early on. Okay, so you have, and so then people wonder why are video games so violent? Okay, why is there so much porn on the web? Why? It's because the imagination is being repressed and censored. Okay, and forcibly cleansed of anything that's authentically animalistic or sexy or you know, or vibrant. Okay, so you have all of the imaginative energy of the universe now going into these other forms where it becomes much more violent. In when people see it, they go, oh, this is so atrocious, this is so awful. Well, guess what, okay? You've made a whole area of life impermissible. You've made all kinds of human desires and fantasies impermissible. And so it has to come out someplace, and that's where it is.
That's right.
Well, that gives you the flavor of the American Academy these days, you know, feminist fainting couches and emasculated men. And clearly the message that the public sent during the 2016 election, where political correctness was absolutely right on the table as an issue, the American public is not buying it anymore, and they chose a man to be president who, I think a decade ago, wouldn't have had a prayer of getting into office. But the disgust at what is going on in our culture, the political correctness, the mania for it, its dictatorial attitudes, its attempts to stifle speech, its attempt to create this unreal bubble that it expects people to live in, while the realities of, you know, economic decline and terror and crime and everything else are, you know, mounting every day, as evidenced by the news tonight of another terrorist attack. People have just said, we've had enough. We have had enough. Now, if Trump sticks to his guns and takes a cleaver to the Department of Education and starts to put through some real reform there, we may see some hope for the American Academy. But I think the market is also going to react, because people are not going to pay $30,000 to $40,000 a year to send their kids to these schools. And employers are not going to want to hire the product that comes out of them. So I think that although it wasn't as explicit an issue in the election as, you know, the more, what would you call, hard issues like immigration and trade, the whole cult of political correctness, which traces back to what's gone on in the Academy, was very much a big factor in the 2016 election. And I think that's one of the reasons why Hillary got rejected by the heartland of the country. So, Phil, anything you want to add?
No, nothing much at all, you know. I mean, you know, this grabbing onto this hacking narrative, to me, is just total denial of what's going on by the Democratic Party.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
it's just denial. They do not get it. And they still don't get it.
And it's beyond sour grapes, because if they had said, well, it was a domestic actor that hacked the election and was responsible, but to, you know, start the equivalent of another Red Scare to make excuses for Hillary's terrible campaign and terrible candidacy, to me, it is just the height of irresponsibility. And that was the point that that guy H.A. Goodman was making on the clip I played earlier. He's saying, you know, Russia is a, you know, it's not as, you know, not an economic superpower like the United States, but it's a great power. They've got nukes. Why are you raising the stakes of a confrontation, Barack Obama, just to save Hillary face for Hillary Clinton? You're crazy.
Well, you know, that link that Carol posted the other day, you know, that's a fairly technical analysis of, you know, what the DHS and FBI said was Russian hacking. Now, I went through that, and you know what? There is no proof in that whatsoever that it was Russia who hacked.
Yeah, I mean, anybody with common sense knows that, you know, hacking is multifaceted. All during the Obama administration, we've had one hack after another. You know, the IRS, Target, Yahoo, Sony, the Defense Department Office of Personnel Management, hack after hack after hack after hack. Obama did nothing, did not wage any kind of public campaign against it. He basically rolled over and played dead. all of a sudden, in the, you know, at the 11th hour and 59th minute of his administration, he's decided it's an issue. It is so irresponsible. And you know, one of the things that, someone pointed out, which I, you know, that occurred to me, and it was good to see it, that it's occurring to other people simultaneously, with the second FBI investigation, where Hillary's emails were, you know, on Wiener's machine. Well, we know that Wiener is a porn addict, and, you know, and Russia is one of the big exporters of porn.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the FSB and the Russian security services that take advantage of hacking. I mean, it's everybody in every line of work, industrial espionage, porn, what have you. They're all at it. It's crazy. I've never seen such gullibility on the part of supposedly educated people.
You know, and you know, the malware that they found is actually downloadable. Anybody can download that.
Well, you know, how many times for people who have anti-spy, anti-malware, antivirus programs on your computer, how many times do you get signals from your software, whatever version or brand you've installed? Don't go to that site. Somebody is attacking
your
computer. Shut that off. Don't go there. Are you sure you want to go there? We think it's malicious. Blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, if you have a totally unencrypted, unprotected server like Hillary had for the first 3 months and you're technically illiterate on top of it, well, of course you're not going to see any warnings. I mean, she laid herself open to every potential hacker in creation, and I don't know why they fixed on Russia. You know, it could be a kid in the basement hacking into her.
The IP addresses, the majority of them were on the TOR browser sites, which a TOR site, TOR browser, you know, disguises your IP address. And then the next group of IP addresses were all U.S. So, they politicized this whole thing. He politicized, and you know, two more federal agencies, Obama.
Yeah. I mean, it really does not reflect very well on him as he goes out of office. I mean, God knows his legacy is so flawed to begin with. But to just blatantly try to undermine the validity of an election with this short-term strategy that is high risk internationally and is sure to be exposed eventually anyway, it just shows that he's fundamentally a very foolish guy, foolish and petty. And why he's doing it for Hillary Clinton, who he does not like, is absolutely beyond me. It makes no sense to me at all why he's doing it, other than petulance. So.
Well, I actually think there's a little bit of arrogance involved in this, in that he sees the rejection of Hillary as a rejection of his policies and his 8 years. And it's like you said, he's petulant over it.
But why is he allying himself with the person who did more to defeat his agenda than Donald Trump? I mean, the reason why his legacy is going out the window is because he, you know, he had the ability to squelch Hillary, and he didn't. And by letting her get that nomination, when by any objective standard she should have been forced to withdraw, he set himself up for what happened. You know, he put all his eggs in that. When Biden decided not to run for whatever reason, and maybe it was because the Democratic establishment had put the fix in for Hillary and she was so far ahead in fundraising, I don't know what the inner dynamics were. I mean, only the principals know. But once Biden signaled he wasn't running, Obama just said, oh, well, we've got to, you know, be good soldiers and get behind Hillary. And I'm like, my God, you, Barack Obama, of all people, know what this woman is like. I mean, she compromised him. Because now he's on the hook because he knew she was violating the law with that server. He can't pretend that he only found out about it with the press, through the press.
Oh, yeah. I know, yeah. Yeah.
That's the problem. When you associate with the Clintons, invariably they draw you into their web and you become accomplices of their criminality. It's like, and this guy, Barack Obama, is supposed to be, you know, such a intelligent guy and a reformer, and he would, you know, and he's got Clinton mud all over him now. She corrupted him too. That was her final, you know, her final achievement. She corrupted everything in the Democratic Party. They've all got fleas and ooze sticking to them. So I don't know. It's crazy. Well, anything else before we end? I mean, it's a light night. I didn't expect many people to drop by, being New Year's Eve. I take it you're home.
Oh, yeah. I just, you know, I actually had to work tonight, but, you know, the NBA and NHL, you know, they still had the games, so we had to stream them. So.
Yeah. It looks, is it cold up there?
It's getting chilly, yeah.
Yeah, we're having another cold wave envelop most of the country. I noticed in watching the news feeds this week that the global warming people are out again. They've been floating a lot of stories about there was an unusually warm Arctic air mass parked over the North Pole, which is adjacent to an unusually cold one, and they're using their propaganda machine to highlight the warm one, ignore the cold one. I think they're trying to do some preemptive striking because they know they don't have a sympathetic audience with Trump, and they're trying to get the narrative out there to revive the global warming story before he gets too settled in. So, you know, it's just a constant battle with these people. You know, I believe that climate, you know, I believe in climate change. I think climate is always changing. And you know, it has changed for many, many thousands and thousands and millions of years. What I don't buy is this causality that only human activity in CO2 emissions drives climate change. I think it's nonsense historically. And if you look at the, you know, the weather history of the planet, I mean, you know, the last ice age 20,000 years ago, well, what caused those glaciers to melt? It certainly wasn't, you know, human industrial activity. I just think that there's a politicized agenda afoot. But I think climate change is real. It's just that nobody knows which way it's going or what causes it. But these people, you know, it's an avenue to wealth and power, and they're going to drive their ideology every chance they get. Well, okay. I see that Bob dropped out, probably getting late, 12:30. So I think I'm going to call it a night here. So, Phil, Happy New Year again.
All right. Happy New Year, Bob.
And we'll be, I think tax season is starting soon, so I'll be working again. And I think the normal time I'm going to do this show will be on Fridays at 7 o'clock Central. But I'm not sure I'll do it every week. I may do it, switch to every 2 weeks. But I wanted to get a few shows in during the holidays because I had the opportunity to do it. So soon we'll be going through the run-up to the inauguration. We'll do a couple of shows on that. So to Phil, thanks for calling in, and for people listening in archive, have a happy New Year, and stay tuned for more shows. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.